Part 2. Trajectory Changes. Chapter 3. Moral Change. Abolition. Despite its abhorrence, slavery was almost ubiquitous historically. In one form or another, slavery was practiced across Europe, Africa, the Americas, and Asia. It existed in almost all early agricultural civilizations, including ancient Mesopotamia, Egypt, China, and India. People were enslaved for a variety of reasons, as a result of conquest or kidnapping, because of inability to repay debts, as punishment for crimes, or because their family sold them. In the Roman Empire, probably at least 10% of the population was enslaved. The Arab world, stretching from modern-day Morocco to modern-day Oman, also had a long-standing and extensive slave trade that lasted until the 20th century. People were bought or raided from Africa, Central Asia, and Christian Europe, and typically forced to work as soldiers or personal servants, or enslaved for sex. Estimates vary, but in total about 12 million people were enslaved in Africa alone in the Trans-Saharan and Indian Ocean slave trades. Slave trading reached its apogee in the transatlantic trade, fueled by Europeans' desire to exploit abundant land and natural resources in the Americas. Over 12 million enslaved people were taken from Africa, including 470,000 to British North America, 1.6 million to the Spanish colonies, 4.2 million to the Caribbean, and 5.5 million to Brazil. Though Europeans sometimes enslaved people by raiding, most often they bought them from African leaders who had enslaved them from other communities. The conditions in transit across the Atlantic were abominable. Enslaved people were packed into transport ships in cramped, poorly ventilated quarters. Disease was rampant. The enslaved were forbidden from using the ship's toilets and were forced to lie in their own feces for weeks. Around 1.5 million people died on those voyages. The suffering of those who survived the journey across the Atlantic is impossible to accurately convey. The enslaved were typically forced to work on plantations, most often those growing sugarcane, tobacco, cotton, or coffee, and sometimes to mine silver or gold. Work days were regularly 10 hours long, and pregnant women and children were sometimes also forced to work. By 1700, enslaved people made up the overwhelming majority of the population of the Caribbean, and their life expectancy at birth was sometimes as low as 20 years. Although most British colonies had codes that regulated treatment of the enslaved, in practice, slave owners acted as judge, jury, and executioner. Whipping was widespread as a means of disincentivizing inefficient labor and keeping enslaved people in a state of fear. It's hard to imagine how people could believe that owning other people was permissible. We might naturally think that slave owners really knew, deep down, that what they were doing was wrong, and that they didn't care. But we should be careful not to presume that the values of other people are more similar to our own than they really are. Slavery was seen as entirely permissible, part of the natural order. Historically, even thinkers who dedicated their lives to moral reflection, often highly progressive in other areas, accepted slavery. These included the classical philosophers Plato and Aristotle, and Enlightenment thinkers, such as Immanuel Kant. Yet, despite its historical ubiquity, its longevity, and its acceptance, and despite the luminaries who defended it, slavery was abolished. Was its abolition inevitable, a result of economic changes or the inexorable march of moral progress? Or was it a contingent matter, where if history had gone down a different path, it might never have occurred? A full account of abolition would require a book in its own right, and would cover the countless acts of resistance, subversion, and bravery by enslaved people throughout history. It would also cover efforts from formerly enslaved people such as Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth, and Harriet Tubman in the United States, and Luiz Gama in Brazil, who shed light on the horrors of slavery, fostered public opposition, and pushed for legislative action. Here, though, I look at just one part of this narrative. Because I'm interested in whether or not abolition was contingent, I'm interested in those parts of the history that seem unexpected were difficult to explain. And as leading historian of abolition, Professor Christopher Leslie Brown puts it, the causes of slave resistance do not seem particularly mysterious. What is surprising, he notes, is that slavery was attacked by those who benefited from it. Moreover, enslaved people have very often throughout history powerfully resisted their oppression. So why was there a successful abolitionist campaign in Britain in the early 1800s and not in any of history's previous slave societies? I think that the activism of a fairly small group of Quakers in the 18th and early 19th centuries provides part of the answer. Their efforts were hugely important in one of the most surprising moral about-faces in history. There were many important figures in this story, but among the early Quaker activists, the most striking was Benjamin Lay. Lay was born in Cotford, England, in 1682. He became a sailor based in London, then a shopkeeper in Barbados, before moving in 1732 to Philadelphia, which at the time was the largest city in British North America and home to the largest Quaker community. Lay was a dwarf, standing at a little over 4 feet tall and hunchbacked. He referred to himself as Little Benjamin, likening himself to Little David, who killed Goliath. Lay's moral radicalism took many forms. He opposed the death penalty and consumerism. Like many of the later abolitionists, and very unusually for the time, he became a vegetarian and even refused to wear leather or wool. Later in his life, he lived in a cave just outside Philadelphia, and, boycotting all goods produced by enslaved people, made all his own clothes, wore undyed fabrics, and refused to drink tea or eat sugar. His opposition to slavery stemmed from his time as a sailor, when he learned of the pervasiveness of rape on the transatlantic slave ships, and from the 2 years he spent in Barbados. Early in his time there, he whipped several enslaved people who, racked by hunger, had stolen food from his shops. He was subsequently stricken with guilt and made friends with a number of enslaved people. One of these friends, a barrel maker, had a master who would whip the people he owned every Monday morning to keep them in awe. One Sunday evening, in order to avoid the next day's brutality, this friend committed suicide. Experiences like this haunted Lay for the rest of his life. Over the course of the 27 years that he lived in Pennsylvania, Lay harangued the Philadelphia Quakers about the horrors of slavery at every opportunity, and he did so in dramatic style. He once stood outside a Quaker meeting in the snow in bare feet with no coat. When passers-by expressed concern, he explained that enslaved people were made to work outside for the whole winter just as he was. During Quaker meetings, as soon as any slave owner tried to speak, it was said that Lay would rise to his feet and shout, "There's another Negro master!" When kicked out of one meeting for making trouble, he lay down in the mud outside the entrance of the meeting house so that every member of the congregation had to step over his body as they left. When he discovered that a local family kept a young girl as a slave, he invited their 6-year-old son to his cave without telling his parents, so that they would briefly know the grief of losing a child. In his most famous stunt, at the 1738 yearly meeting of the Quakers, he came dressed in military uniform under a large cloak, carrying a hollow book filled with fake blood. During the meeting, he allegedly rose to his feet, threw off his cloak, and exclaimed, "Oh, all you Negro masters who are contentedly holding your fellow creatures in a state of slavery, you might as well throw off the plain coat as I do. It would be as justifiable in the sight of the Almighty, who beholds and respects all nations and colors of men with an equal regard, if you should thrust a sword through their hearts, as I do through this book." As he spoke, he splattered the gathering with fake blood. John Woolman, who later became one of the most influential Quaker abolitionists, was likely in the audience that day. Lay became well known across Pennsylvania, but he was not revered in his time for his activism. In fact, he was effectively disowned 4 times by Quaker societies in London, Colchester, Philadelphia, and Abington. But he seems ultimately to have been influential within Quaker circles. In the late 1790s, Benjamin Rush wrote that a print of Lay was seen in many houses in Philadelphia. Leigh was also friends with Anthony Benezet, who helped to make abolition mainstream in Britain. And Leigh's activism coincided with a time when moral sentiment among Quakers changed dramatically. In the period of 1681 to 1705, an estimated 70% of the leaders of the Quakers' yearly meeting owned people. For the period 1754 to 1780, that figure was only 10%. In the 1758 Philadelphia yearly meeting, it was decided that Quakers who traded people would be disciplined and then disowned, though it would be another 18 years before owning people was also banned. When Leigh was told, he reportedly shouted, "Thanksgiving and praise be rendered unto the Lord God. I can now die in peace." He passed away 1 year later. One can find buds of abolitionist thought throughout history. Enslaved people themselves frequently and often violently objected to the inhumane treatment they suffered. Moralists occasionally condemned slavery's cruelties, sometimes worrying about its effect on the enslavers as well as the enslaved. They recommended treating enslaved people better, or releasing them as a matter of charity or for religious reasons. Many were uneasy about how the institution could coexist with certain tenets of their faith, or, for various 18th century Enlightenment thinkers, with the principles of universalism or natural rights. In practical terms, some rulers occasionally tried to increase the freedom of their subjects in order to curtail the power of their nobles or prevent uprisings. But the Quakers seemed to be the first group in history to organize a campaign for abolition, push for public support, and seek to stamp out slavery entirely. The activism of Leigh and others inspired a generation of abolitionists who provided a crucial bridge between North American Quaker thought and mass appeal in Britain. Anthony Benezet was particularly influential. He founded a school for young black people in 1770 to demonstrate that they were as intellectually capable as white people. Many of the students, such as Absalom Jones, Richard Allen, and James Fortin, went on to become leading campaigners for abolition themselves. Benezet's work also inspired Thomas Clarkson, a co-founder of the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade, to take up the cause. Clarkson in turn convinced the parliamentarian William Wilberforce to become the political leader of the British abolitionist movement. Working together with formerly enslaved people, such as Olodi Equiano and Ottoba Koguano, who formed the Sons of Africa, Britain's first black political organization, the abolitionists' campaign in Britain was enormously successful. Britain's Parliament was persuaded to abolish the slave trade in 1807 and to make owning people illegal across most of the British Empire in 1833. After 1807, the British government resolved to stamp out slave trading worldwide. They used diplomacy and bribery to persuade other nations to ban the transatlantic slave trade and used the Royal Navy's West Africa squadron to police the seas. This made it harder for slave ships to travel between West Africa, the United States, and the American and Caribbean colonies of France, Spain, Portugal, and Holland. The campaign ultimately captured more than 2,000 slave ships and freed over 200,000 enslaved people, although those freed were often exploited in other ways and sent to work across the British Empire. The abolition of slavery was an example of a values change, by which I mean a change in the moral attitudes of society, or in how those attitudes are implemented and enforced. In my view, the abolition of slavery was one of the most important value changes in all of history. Over the course of this chapter and the next, I'll argue that changing society's values is particularly important from a long-termist perspective. This chapter will look at the significance and contingency of values changes. The next chapter will discuss their persistence. The significance of values. The significance of a state of affairs is how good or bad it is at any point in time. The example of slavery makes the significance of value changes obvious. Abolition freed millions of people from lives of utter misery. But it is far from the only example of the extreme significance of moral values. Consider moral views on the status of women. Throughout history, women have been systematically oppressed. In 1832, 25 years after it abolished the slave trade, the British government passed the Great Reform Act to officially prohibit women from voting. Today, women can vote in every democracy in the world and have far greater opportunities to work and participate in public life. But since attitudes regarding gender roles still vary widely across different countries, some women have more opportunities than others. For example, Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam, India, and Pakistan all have about the same income per capita. In Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, about 3 out of every 4 women participate in the labor force, while in India and Pakistan, fewer than 1 in 4 do. Other examples abound. In the last few decades, attitudes towards LGBTQ+ people have changed dramatically in many countries. The first US state to legalize gay marriage was Massachusetts in 2004. Just 11 years later, a Supreme Court decision legalized it nationwide. As a result of these changing attitudes, millions of people are now more able to live full, enfranchised lives. Corporal punishment in schools, widespread throughout much of the 20th century, is now prohibited in more than 120 countries. Evolving attitudes towards nationalism and immigration have life-changing implications for the hundreds of millions of international migrants. One estimate found that, on average, for a low-skill worker, moving to the United States boosts their annual income by over $15,000 per year. And it's not only people who are affected by our values. Landscapes and ecosystems can be reshaped by the extent to which we value nature. Our attitudes towards animal welfare have huge implications for the billions of animals that are raised in factory farms. Values changes are significant because they have major impacts on the lives of people and other beings. But from a long-termist perspective, they are particularly significant compared to other sorts of changes we might make because their effects are unusually predictable. If you promote a particular means of achieving your goals, like a particular policy, you run the risk that the policy might not be very good at achieving your goal in the future, especially if the world in the future is very different from today, with a very different political, cultural, and technological environment. You might also lose out on the knowledge that we will gain in the future, which might change whether we even think that this policy is a good idea. In contrast, if you can ensure that people in the future adopt a particular goal, then you can trust them to pursue whatever strategies make the most sense, in whatever environment they are in, and with whatever additional information they have. You can therefore be fairly confident that you have made the achievement of that goal more likely, even if you have no idea at all what the world will be like when those future people act. The dead hand problem in philanthropy illustrates the importance of promoting goals rather than means. Often the founders of a charity specify a constitution that directs the future behaviour of that charity in ways that become absurd over time. One example is ScotsCare, the charity for Scots in London, which is dedicated to improving the lives of Scottish Londoners. This particular goal made sense at the time of the charity's founding in 1611. At that time, Scotland and England had only recently come under the rule of the same king. Scots in London were immigrants, and some were unusually deprived and unable to receive support from their local parish, the equivalent of social security at the time. But this goal makes less sense 400 years later. London is the most affluent city in the UK, and as far as I can tell, Scots nowadays face no particular disadvantages there. In contrast, many areas within Scotland are far more deprived. Presumably, the founders of the charity did not care about Scots in London per se. They just cared about their fellow nationals. They would have done better at achieving their aims if they had directed the charity to pursue the goal they fundamentally cared about. Do whatever will be best to improve the lives of Scots, rather than mandating a very particular way of reaching that goal. For these reasons, changing values has particularly great significance from a long-term perspective. Looking to the past, we see that such changes have had an enormous impact on the lives of billions of people. Looking to the future, if we can improve the values that guide the behaviour of generations to come, we can be pretty confident that they will take better actions, even if they're living in a world very different from our own, the nature of which we cannot predict. The contingency of values. However, if some change we make to society's values would simply have happened anyway, then the long-run impact of that change is not so great. So we also need to consider the expected contingency of values changes. We need to ask, if we don't bring about some change to society's values, how long, in expectation, would it take for that change to happen anyway? Today, we say the abolitionist movement had a crucial role in ending slavery. But if, for some reason, abolition was inevitable, then over the long run, the changes the abolitionists fought for would have happened anyway, at some later date. Contingency can vary depending on the timescale we're considering. It's more plausible that major changes like the abolition of slavery or women's suffrage, had they not occurred when they did, would have happened 100 years later than that they would never have happened. For now, I'll focus on expected contingency on the order of hundreds of years. Values changes with this level of contingency are important in their own right, affecting many generations and often billions of people. But in the next chapter, I'll also argue that there's a significant chance that the dominant values in the world over the next few centuries could get locked in and persist for an extremely long time. The values that are commonplace in the next few centuries might shape the entire course of the future. To help us get clarity on the contingency of values over the course of history, we can consider an analogy to the contingency of biology over the course of evolution. Organisms have traits that affect their reproductive success, or fitness. Evolution occurs because these traits vary, and some lead to more reproductive success than others. Evolutionary contingency has been a topic of debate for decades. Evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould thought that evolution is highly contingent. He claimed that if the tape of life were rerun, even very slight changes in the distant past could lead to huge differences in life on Earth today. Gould even speculated that the re-evolution of life with human-level intelligence would be unlikely. The existence of evolutionary idiosyncrasies, like the elephant's trunk or the giraffe's neck, gives some evidence for contingency in evolution. If evolution were consistently convergent across a wide variety of environments, we would expect these traits to have evolved more than once. Or consider New Zealand, which has been isolated ever since it split off from Australia about 80 million years ago. The island lacks any terrestrial native mammals, and in their absence, it became an empire of birds, with birds evolving to occupy an unusual range of evolutionary niches. These include the kiwi, which scavenges for insects on the forest floor, the kea, a parrot that, uniquely, lives in cold, high-altitude environments, and the now-extinct Haast's eagles, which are thought to have weighed up to 15 kilograms, almost twice the size of any eagle alive today. However, in other cases we see convergent evolution, where species starting from very different places end up evolving the same traits. For example, insects, birds, pterosaurs, and bats all evolved the ability to fly, despite different evolutionary histories. Similarly, we see streamlined bodies in fish, swimming mammals, and some mollusks. And crustaceans tend to evolve towards crab-like forms so often that the process of becoming a crab has its own name, carcinization. Today, the consensus among biologists is that evolution can sometimes be contingent and sometimes non-contingent. This can be seen by considering what's called the fitness landscape. In the fitness landscape, one or more dimensions measure the variation in an organism's traits. For example, for an elephant, this could include its body mass, the length of its trunk, and its sociability. The final dimension measures that organism's evolutionary fitness as a function of its traits. The peaks in the landscape show which trait or combination of traits maximize the organism's fitness. Variation, like that caused by genetic mutation, causes individuals to occupy slightly different positions on the landscape. Those closer to the peak will be more likely to pass their traits on to the next generation. Sometimes there will be just one peak. Evolution will then push species towards that single peak no matter where in the landscape they begin. For example, almost any sort of swimming animal will evolve a streamlined body. In other cases, there are multiple peaks in the landscape, such as when there are different ways of adapting to the same environment. Beavers and platypuses both make slow-moving creeks and rivers their home, but they have very different traits. When there is more than one peak, we say there are multiple equilibria. This introduces contingency into evolution, since which peak an organism ends up climbing will depend on where it starts in the fitness landscape, how that landscape is shaped, and the randomness inherent to genetic mutation. The contingency of biological evolution can be high if there are multiple equilibria. But even if there is only one equilibrium, expected contingency can be high if it simply takes a long time for that equilibrium to be reached, if evolution is slow at climbing the fitness landscape. For example, there were around 700 million years between the evolution of the first neurons and the evolution of human-level intelligence. It's possible that human-level intelligence was always a peak on the fitness landscape, and it was just a very slow journey to get there. There could be many viable paths up to this peak, and if so, then the forms of intelligence that evolved would be contingent for 700 million years. In recent decades, the theory of evolution and the fitness landscape has been used to understand the evolution of cultures, including values. It can help us understand when and why values might be contingent. In this theory, culture is understood broadly as any socially transmitted information, such as beliefs, knowledge, skills, and practices, though I will focus just on values. Cultural evolution can be described by the same three principles that govern Darwinian evolution: variation, cultural traits vary in their characteristics; differential fitness, cultural traits with different characteristics have different rates of survival and reproduction; inheritance, cultural traits can be transmitted from person to person via imitation or speech. So, for example, there are a variety of possible cultural attitudes to outgroup members, from friendliness to hostility. Some of these cultural attitudes will be better adapted to a given environment than others. Those attitudes that are better adapted are more likely to be passed on to peers and to the next generation. In models of cultural evolution, one can get cultural competition between individuals and between groups. The lens of cultural evolution is helpful for understanding both the past and the future. As cultures interact with each other and adapt to their environment over time, new cultures and traits arise, and old cultures either evolve or are outcompeted. To be clear, I'm certainly not claiming that the traits which enable a culture to spread make it better than other cultures. We should be extremely worried that those cultures that have the highest fitness and are most likely to win out over time may not be those that are most desirable. As leading anthropologist Joe Henrich points out, norms that grossly devalue outgroup members can be favored by intergroup selection, motivating members of the tribe or nation to exterminate their competition. Just as there are fitness landscapes for organisms' traits, there are fitness landscapes for cultures' values. When such a landscape has a single peak, we should expect cultures to converge on the specific values represented by that peak. Changing values would then be low in contingency. It doesn't seem surprising that norms in favor of caring for children are widespread. Cultures without such norms are less likely to have healthy kids and less likely to thrive over time. Similarly, cultures that seek to win converts and spread themselves as widely as possible, like proselytizing religions, seem more likely to grow than cultures that lack this trait. So, again, it doesn't seem surprising that many of the world's largest religions, like Christianity and Islam, value converting others to their faith. However, there can also be multiple peaks in the fitness landscape, meaning that even in the long run, different cultures could stably end up with very different values. For example, consider the phenomenon of conspicuous consumption. Wealthy individuals buying goods to show off in very public ways how much wealth they have. The universality of conspicuous consumption suggests that there is cultural evolutionary pressure towards it. But the form that it takes is highly contingent. In some cultures, it can take the form of purchasing luxury goods. In others, it can take the form of philanthropy. In others still, it can take the form of owning enslaved people. Some of these forms of conspicuous consumption are far preferable to others. For another example, note that in many religions, it is important for adherents to demonstrate their piety or moral integrity. But different religions have developed very different ways of accomplishing this goal. Many Buddhists and Hindus demonstrate piety and moral integrity by being vegetarian. The same is not true for most Christians. This in part explains why 1 in 5 people in Asia say they are vegetarian, while only 1 in 20 in Europe and North America do. Similarly, China, Korea, and Vietnam all consume more than 30 kilograms of pork per person per year, whereas that number is close to zero for Muslim or Jewish countries such as Iran, Pakistan, Indonesia, and Israel. Religious norms around sex, marriage, work, and charity are similarly diverse. Depending on one's religious background, the actions you take to show that you are an honorable or pious person can vary greatly. Though these different equilibria might be equally good from the perspective of cultural fitness, they can be much better or worse from a moral perspective. If you think that eating meat is morally wrong, then the fact that Hinduism and Buddhism converged on vegetarianism to show moral integrity is a very good thing. A second reason for the expecting multiple equilibria in moral attitudes is that value systems entrench themselves, suppressing ideological competition. To see this, consider some of history's many ideological purges. Between AD 1209 and 1229, the inappropriately named Pope Innocent III carried out the Albigensian Crusade with the goal of eradicating Catholicism, an unorthodox Christian sect in southern France. His goal was eventually accomplished. About 200,000 Cathars were killed in the Crusade, and Catholicism was wiped out across Europe by 1350. British history is also replete with examples of monarchs trying to suppress religious opposition. In the 16th century, Mary I had Protestants burned at the stake and ordered everyone to attend Catholic Mass. Just a few years later, Elizabeth I executed scores of Catholics and passed the boldly named Act of Uniformity, which outlawed Catholic Mass and penalised people for not attending Anglican services. Ideological purges have been common throughout the 20th century too. On the night of the Long Knives, Hitler crushed opposition from within his own party, cementing his position as supreme ruler of Germany. In Stalin's Great Terror, around 1 million people were murdered between 1936 and 1938, purging the Communist Party and civil society of any opposition to him. In 1975 to 1976, Pol Pot seized power in Cambodia and turned it into a one-party state. Intellectuals were regarded as ideological enemies and could be murdered on the basis of the most meagre evidence. One refugee commented that you could be killed just for wearing eyeglasses. In 1978, after consolidating his power, Pol Pot reportedly told members of his party that their slogan should be "Purify the party, purify the army, purify the cadres." In a little more than 3 years, the Khmer Rouge killed about 25% of the Cambodian population. Entrenchment of values creates multiple equilibria because there is a significant element of chance in which value system becomes most powerful at a particular place and time, and because once a value system has become sufficiently powerful, it can stay that way by suppressing the competition. Moreover, the theory of cultural evolution helps to explain why the predominant cultures in society tend to entrench themselves. Simply, those cultures that do not entrench themselves in this way are, over time, more likely to die off than those that do. The final reason why the expected contingency of moral change can be high is that, even in cases where there's a single equilibrium, the process of reaching it might be slow. If selection pressures are not particularly strong, or there are few opportunities for change, then cultures might find themselves at many different points on the fitness landscape, and only converge at a peak after long periods of time. North Korea's governance culture seems much less fit than South Korea's, as evidenced by the former's decades-long economic stagnation. But the North's regime has managed to survive for over 70 years. With these considerations in mind, we can see today a number of value differences both within and between countries, where those differences seem highly contingent. Anti-abortion attitudes are strongest, and the laws against abortion strictest, in the Catholic countries of Chile, the Dominican Republic, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Vatican City, and Malta. For women's workforce participation, though there's a weak U-shaped trend with respect to GDP per capita, with the poorest and richest countries more likely to have greater workforce participation, there is an enormous amount of variation across countries. Muslim-majority countries like Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia have particularly low levels of female labour force participation, though of course there are exceptions, such as Kazakhstan. Women's workforce participation is reflected in cultural attitudes too. Egypt and Peru both have GDP per capita of about $12,000, but in Egypt, about 80% of people think that men have more rights to a job than women do, and fewer than 20% of women participate in the labour force. While in Peru, only 20% of people think that men have more right to a job than women do, and 70% of women participate in the labour force. Attitudes towards new biomedical technologies, such as cloning and genetic enhancement, vary substantially across countries too. For example, the proportion of people who think it's acceptable to change a baby's genetic characteristics to make that child more intelligent ranges from 8% in Japan to 64% in India. In general, countries in Asia seem more open to genetic enhancement than countries in Europe and the Americas, though there's a lot of regional variation. Similarly, across countries, there are stark differences in willingness to fight for one's country, from 13% in Japan to 96% in Vietnam. In attitudes towards immigrants, in the average high-income country, 14% of the population is foreign-born, while just 2% of the populations of Japan and South Korea are. And in rates of vegetarianism. One study estimated that India has about 10 times more vegetarians per capita than Brazil. The same is true for levels of philanthropy. People in primarily Buddhist countries tend to give more to charity, with over 50% of people in Myanmar and Sri Lanka stating that they gave money to charity in the last month. In many of these cases, facts about a country's history plausibly explain the values its citizens have today. Putting this all together, we have both theoretical reasons for expecting values to often be contingent and a number of examples where this contingency seems clear. But what about the example with which we led this chapter, the abolition of slavery? Might even that have been a contingent event?